Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, another story from The Tell, a moving story of culture shock, kindness, and unexpected belonging as a newly married American recounts her first trip to her husband's remote Sudanese village. We'll also visit North Dakota's Gateway to Science, where a new grant is expanding hands-on learning with their live honeybee hive. As Main Street begins today, we're launching A Closer Look with the Monitor. It's a partnership with Prairie Public and Main Street and the North Dakota Monitor, an independent source for watchdog reporting on state government, public policy, and other critical issues affecting all of us in the Peace Garden State. This podcast will be posted weekly Friday mornings on the Monitor's website at northdakotamonitor.com and major podcast platforms. It will also be available on Main Street's broadcast and podcast every Thursday, like today. And today we launch with the topic of agriculture and what's ahead for farmers. North Dakota farmers are heading into 2026 under mounting financial pressure. Crop yields have been solid, but profits remain thin. Emergency loan programs are expanding, and global forces from trade policy to fertilizer markets are reshaping agriculture in ways that are hard to control at the farm gate. Much of what we know about this comes from careful, in-depth reporting. Jeff Beach is the deputy editor at the North Dakota Monitor, and he's the author of a recent story that takes a close look at why many farmers may not be set up for success in the year ahead. You can read his full reporting and analysis at the North Dakota Monitor. Jeff joins us now to talk through what he's found and what it means to the future of farming in North Dakota. Jeff, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, happy to be here.
Jeff, your reporting opens with a sense of prolonged stress. Might be a great way to classify it in agriculture. And when you talk with farmers and ag economists, what's the overall mood heading into the new year, into 2026?
Well, you know, farmers are an optimistic bunch. Generally, you have to be kind of in agriculture to plant a seed and have confidence that it's going to sprout and grow and be something you can harvest. But you know, I think a lot of farmers are also pretty realistic that, you know, they're not holding a winning hand, you know, maybe going into 2026, but they're trying to, you know, kind of play the long game, you know, stay in the game for some better cards down the road. So they're not super optimistic, but I think they're, you know, they want to stay in the game.
Jeff, tell me a little bit about yourself before we march on here. You have a little bit of history of farming in your own family.
Yeah, I grew up on a farm near Hillsboro, North Dakota, and you know, my dad retired when I was fairly young, but so avoided kind of the farm crisis of the 1980s that saw a lot of farms go under and people dealing with high interest rates and low prices. So my parents chose wisely as to not to reinvest in a lot of land and equipment, and instead kind of cash in at an optimum time. And I was kind of benefited from that.
Jeff, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has rolled out the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program, and North Dakota has expanded state loan programs. From your perspective, are these being seen as lifelines or signs that something deeper is wrong?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if I would call them lifelines. I might call them, you know, Band-Aids instead of lifelines. And I think one of the issues that the farm economy is facing is that, you know, or I've heard other economists talk about, is saying you keep putting Band-Aids on top of Band-Aids, and pretty soon you don't know what the actual wound looks like, and your, you know, policies kind of end up stacking up on top of each other. So you know, one of the things you might argue about is, you know, is the wound self-inflicted, you know, as far as trade policy especially, but you know, I think what the wound actually looked like is maybe a kind of a broader discussion.
You spoke with Bank of North Dakota President Don Morgan, and I think that he told you that the loans are meant to get farmers not just into 26 but into 2027. So what was your perspective on what he was telling you about how serious the financial outlook is?
Yeah, I think it is pretty serious, or else, you know, the bank wouldn't be getting involved in the first place. And you know, there are some some federal policies changes that some people are optimistic will kick in 2026 that will help farmers going into the next crop year. But nobody's exactly sure how it's all going to shake out, of course. I think especially for the smaller operators that may this is the time of the year that they're working with their bank, getting their operating loan for the upcoming season, and putting together a plan that they hope can be profitable. These loans, I think, really help underpin those operators that otherwise might be struggling to find the capital that they need just to get started in the crop year.
And the scale of the state response is striking. You've kind of alluded to that. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in loan programs, from grain storage rebuilding to covering losses from 2024 and 2025. Do you have a sense, perhaps historically, how unusual this level of intervention is? And I know that you haven't really examined the full history of where we're at today, but from visiting with folks, what are they feeling about this sort of response and the hundreds of millions of dollars that are now being used to lift up farmers?
Well, I think the farmers are reluctant to use them, but they are a tool that they can use. I think the grain storage program, especially, I think is somewhat unique in the state's history, with kind of the high winds, tornadoes, derecho, whatever you want to call it, that wiped out a lot of storage facilities especially in eastern North Dakota in 2025. You know, that program is kind of unique, I think, and I think can really be more useful than some of the other more general loans for people who have specific needs on storage and helping them market their crop at the most optimal time.
You spoke with NDSU Extension economist Brian Parman, and you talked about concerns about emergency programs as becoming routine. What did he tell you on whether this is a warning sign or whether it's a solution?
Yeah, I mean, I think he thinks it's more of a warning sign, going back to that Band-Aid on top of Band-Aids. You know, if you have a one-year kind of emergency program, you know, like the grain storage program, and that helps get farmers through a rough spot, well, that's great. If you just have to kind of keep having emergency loan programs or disaster aid or, you know, drought aid, any kind of farm payment, he sees it as a sign that there's probably a bigger problem that needs to be addressed.
A key theme that we read in your story is really the disconnect between strong yields and weak profitability. If farmers are producing well, then why aren't the numbers working? What did you learn?
Well, one thing I've heard from several people in the ag industry is that, you know, in other cycles where we've had weak commodity prices, the input costs have also kind of cycled down to or gotten lower, cheaper seed, cheaper fertilizer, cheaper fuel, all those kinds of things, the farm chemicals, herbicides, pesticides that farmers need, you know, those things haven't really dipped in price the same way that they have in previous cycles. And that's one thing that kind of, I think, is unusual about this situation and maybe a bigger cause for concern is that it's really, that's really putting the squeeze on producers' profits, if there are profits at all. You know, those fuel prices have gone down, and fuel, you know, drives a lot of other costs, like, you know, producing fertilizer is a very fuel-intensive process. But fertilizer prices are still fairly high, and there seems to be, you know, more competition from other countries for things like fertilizer, and that is kind of keeping those prices high, even if, you know, you might not expect them to stay high in the U.S.
Joining my conversation with Jeff Beach, he's the deputy editor at the North Dakota Monitor, and he's the author of a recent story that's taking a close look at why many farmers may not be set up for success in the year ahead here in North Dakota. And this is a special conversation because we're also launching a closer look with the Monitor. It's a partnership between Prairie Public and Main Street and the North Dakota Monitor. Each week, we're going to take a look at a big story that the Monitor has covered and is working on. It's kind of plays forward what we've been doing now for the last month or so and kind of making it a little bit more formal. And we look forward now to having these conversations every Thursday here on Main Street. And the broadcast will be available Friday at NorthDakotaMonitor.com and wherever you can subscribe to your podcasts. Jeff, are there signs of optimism for farmers?
Yeah, I think there are signs of optimism. Farmers are always an optimistic bunch. Yields have been good in the last couple of years, and so farmers can be somewhat confident that their production will still be there. One bright spot in the ag economy has been the beef industry, which is mostly in western North Dakota, but they are experiencing experienced in 2025 some record high prices, and still seem to be faring fairly well. You know, a lot of consumers complain about beef prices at the grocery store, but demand has not really diminished. So even though the complaints are there, the sales are still there too. So it's a good time for beef producers as kind of one bright spot. You know, there are some other things happening in North Dakota. North Dakota is trying to catch up on livestock production from, you know, beef has been the big mainstay. But there are some signs that big dairy farms proposed in the Red River Valley and under construction that could provide more of a local market for the corn and feed products that we produce here. And there are two soybean crush plants now operating in the state that also help provide more of a local market for soybeans. Even though that once those soybeans get crushed, a lot of that product still has to get exported.
I want to talk about another theme that was central to your reporting, that's land prices. You report that farmland is selling for $10,000 to $20,000 an acre in some cases. And those prices, Jeff, must affect both established farmers and then young producers who are trying to get started.
Yeah, I mean, the high prices, you know, the high land values are good for farmers on the balance sheet. You know, it makes it easier for a farmer to borrow more, you know, for operating capital if they own a lot of their land. Ag land is not subject to the same property taxes that residential property is in North Dakota, so the fact that the value of it goes up does not really hurt them tax-wise. But it for a younger producer that's trying to expand a little bit or own more of their land rather than rent from a neighbor or an absentee landowner, the increase in land values has definitely made it harder for them to kind of get more of their own land on their balance sheet and have something more to borrow against. So it does have kind of a double-edged sword, especially for the younger people.
You also looked at global forces and especially trade. We all heard about the soybean issues relative to China's decision to no longer initially at least purchase soybean products from the United States. So how much of today's soybean price pressure still traces back to the Trump administration's trade war with China?
Well, I think that is a big factor. And even going back to the first Trump administration and the trade war that prompted, a round of market relief payments during that administration, I don't think China ever quite returned to the level that they had been as a buyer before that first trade war, and they have made some commitments to buy more U.S. soybeans, but those have been those purchases have been slow in coming. The deadline has been extended. Whether those purchases actually happen or if China is just kind of stalling for time while they can shop around mostly in South America for a cheaper soybean supply. So, if they keep shopping and the concern is that North Dakota and the United States is losing China as a soybean market for the long term and not just for a year or two.
Jeff, you also spoke with North Dakota Farmers Union President Mark Watney about Brazil's rapid egg expansion. Kind of just alluded to that in our little chat about China here. How does that change the U.S. position in global markets, especially with China?
Well, Brazil has become a real competitor with the United States for ag exports, especially soybeans into China. They've invested a lot in agriculture. Some would say they've have not been environmentally responsible, chopping down the rainforest, things like that. But Mark Watney says that you know, they can expand production now without even adding more farmland or cutting down more of the rainforest. You know, better use of fertilizer. They can afford to import more fertilizer and increase yields that way. They've just got better equipment, better infrastructure, more ability to export efficiently and compete with the United States. So they are a force to be reckoned with.
When you look beyond 2026, Jeff, is there concern more or less about one bad year, or more or less about whether the current ag business model is sustainable? What are people telling you about that?
Kind of as I said before, one concern about China in particular is, you know, did we lose this market for just for 1 year, or is this something that's going to be a long-term trend that we're going to struggle to sell soybeans into the Chinese market for years to come? So that's I think one real strong concern. I think you know, the global supply and demand, you know, it's just not in farmers' favor right now. There could be some things that help balance that out again, whether it's you know, whether it's drought in some part of the world or another, or increasing demand for some food products. You know, a lot of our products that are exported become livestock feed, and as more of the developing world gains an appetite for beef and pork, that could bode well for markets in the long term. But there is a year-to-year situation, as it always is with agriculture.
You've spent months reporting on this, Jeff, and as we kind of wrap things up, I want to ask you a two-part question. What's one thing that you think first policymakers and then second the public most misunderstand about what farmers here in North Dakota are dealing with right now? Let's take policymakers first.
Well, you know, I think policymakers generally understand the problems. I just don't think there are a lot of easy solutions for them to tap into. One thing that North Dakota has, and the country in general, has embraced in the last couple of decades has been biofuels. And there are some policy changes that could increase the use of biofuels in the country and in the Midwest in general. North Dakota has also been trying to promote more animal agriculture, so that more of the corn and soybeans that we grow in the state can be fed to livestock here in North Dakota rather than having it sent to China or to Canada or to neighboring states to be used as livestock feed. Those are kind of a couple of things that could help farmers, but how much of a bump that turns into is hard to say.
What about the public, Jeff? What have you found is maybe most misunderstood from their perspective about what farmers deal with day in and day out, year in and year out?
Well, you know, I think, you know, I don't know if the public understands this or not, but farmers want to be independent and you know, do not want to rely on government programs. They want open markets. I guess one thing that maybe is misunderstood by some people is in the biofuel industry that some people will say, well, why are we just growing corn to turn into ethanol? Well, the livestock feed is still a byproduct of ethanol. You know, you use it to make ethanol, but there's still the livestock feed byproduct that comes out of that. And, you know, farmers are buying, you know, what they call dry distillers grains from ethanol plants all the time. And, you know, when you're crushing soybeans, you can get oil for biofuel, but then there's also the meal that mostly gets used as livestock feed. So I think some people maybe don't understand how that works in the biofuels industry. But biofuels, is potentially still a long-term market driver for ag products here in North Dakota and elsewhere.
That's Jeff Beach. He's the deputy editor at the North Dakota Monitor, and his reporting about ag goes far deeper than the numbers and policies and the lived reality of farmers across the state. And you can read his great reporting, full story, and in-depth coverage at the North Dakota Monitor. And again, this will be available as part of a closer look with the Monitor podcast partnership now between Prairie Public and Main Street and the North Dakota Monitor, which is an independent source for watchdog reporting on state government, public policies, and critical issues affecting all of us right here in North Dakota. We look forward to the wide variety of topics, Jeff, that we'll be visiting with you and with other reporters at the North Dakota Monitor about in the weeks and months to come. Thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Craig, thanks for having me. We're looking forward for this partnership to really be beneficial to readers and listeners in the state.
And we now bring in Amy Darwimple, who is the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor, North Dakota's state newsroom outlet, and she'll be joining us periodically on A Closer Look with the Monitor to share what she and her team are working on and to highlight the stories readers should be watching for at the Monitor. Amy, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks, Craig. Happy to be here.
Next week, Amy, will be a busy week relative to state government news. There's a meeting you're going to be watching closely, and that's legislative management. Bring us up to date on what's ahead.
Absolutely. That committee of legislative leaders will meet next Wednesday, and that's when we expect to get a better sense of what could happen in the January 21st special session. As listeners probably recall, Governor Kelly Armstrong called this special session so the legislature can allocate the $199 million the state has received in federal rural health funding.
Amy, there's quite a few draft bill requests that have been submitted ahead of the special session.
Yes, although this special session is supposed to be designed to discuss the federal rural health funding, we're aware of about 20 bill draft requests that have been submitted to legislative council to work on. One of those is a request that Representative Mike Nathy is working on related to providing school meals to all K-12 students, similar to a ballot measure that circulates.
So would that then maybe prevent the need to have that ballot measure, Amy?
Potentially, there could be an advantage to putting the program in state law rather in the state constitution, which is what the ballot measure would do. That would give legislators a bit more flexibility in the future if this program would become unsustainable. But we're not sure if legislative leaders will allow that topic or other topics to be introduced. That's why we're really keeping an eye on this meeting next week, because it'll give us a sense of whether they have a hard line and limit it, or if they let other topics get introduced as well.
Also next week will be a legislature's Rural Health Transformation Committee meeting that you'll be covering, and that is kind of a prelude, what you just introduced us to just a moment ago.
Yeah, the lawmakers that are on that committee, which is a very large segment of the legislature, they are going to be discussing the recent funding award from the federal government and also work on bill drafts for the special session.
Of course, you'll be able to read all of this at the North Dakota Monitor's website, but it's not just the special session that's out in front. Here, there's also public hearings on the JetX transmission line that's proposed between Jamestown and Ellendale.
Yeah, the Public Service Commission began some technical hearings. But next week, there are going to be hearings where the public will have the opportunity to weigh in.
And then on Friday, the State Investment Board meets to discuss likely a controversial bonuses proposal.
Yeah, the board is considering about $1.3 million in bonuses for state investment employees. And they indicated that they would likely act on those bonuses in January. However, it could be delayed because some lawmakers have requested an attorney general's opinion.
Amy, we're pleased that you are with us, and we are pleased about this partnership, this update on A Closer Look with the Monitor. We certainly thank you for sharing what's ahead at the North Dakota Monitor. And of course, you can find new episodes and follow along every Thursday here on Main Street and every Friday at NorthDakotaMonitor.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Amy, lots to look forward to.
Thanks, Craig. Yeah, please check out our reporting next week. It's going to be a busy one for state government news.
Still to come on Main Street, a moving story from the Tell, a visit to the Gateway to Science, and a review of this week's news. That's all ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and it's Thursday, and we're back in the saddle with our great news director here at Prairie Public, Dave Thompson. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Craig. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. And Dave, and boy, it's been a big news weekend with the impact of the ICE shooting that we all learned about yesterday in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. You've understood that there are some ICE relationships, I guess, if you will, here in North Dakota.
What I found out, and I found this out listening to an interim committee, an interim legislative committee, that there are some of the regional jails, like the county jails, are actually holding ICE prisoners who are arrested in Minnesota. They're shipped here because overcrowding in Minnesota prisons and not enough space because of the overcrowding. So they are making some money off ICE prisoners here. They're not getting the real violent prisoners at this point.
Well, relative to the shooting yesterday, of course, our hearts are with all of those involved.
I've got to say one thing, Craig, about the shootings yesterday. I saw the video and I saw what happened on the video, but I happened to hear a commentator on one of the news networks basically saying, the problem is everybody has rushed to judgment right away. Said, let's look at this. Let's investigate to see what exactly happened. So maybe we'll learn more, but you know, it looks like one thing, but maybe there was something else.
Well, we will watch as this story evolves, Dave, and I know that you'll help us through that. Let's turn to North Dakota news, Dave. The PSC, the Public Service Commission, has held hearings relative to a proposed battery storage facility. What's the latest?
Okay, they have approved the battery storage facility, which is going to be located in Emmons County. It's going to be close to a new wind farm that's being built there, and this is a way to provide some backup, because the problem with wind power, if the wind doesn't blow, you don't have any power. But now you've got storage batteries, which will allow some of that wind generation electricity to be stored to be used at certain peak times. So this is the first of its kind in the state. It's technology that has proven to be somewhat successful in other states, so they're thinking this is going to help.
I'm curious, Dave, is whether this technology will progress relative to the current administration's return, if you will, back to fossil fuels. Have legislators been talking at all about that?
They've just been whispering about it. They haven't talked a lot openly about that. And there is a lot of support for our fossil fuel industries in North Dakota in the legislature. There has been the idea among a number of governors that we should embrace all of the above energy strategy. So maybe there's some, you know, things that might be a little tug and pull right there.
In my home state of Wyoming, Dave, the messaging has changed just a little bit from all of the above to the best of the above. So We'll see how that plays out. There's a little semantic difference there, but it's sure notable to me.
Do you know if they've done any more with the nuclear situation?
Yes, absolutely. It's marching forward in Kemmerer, and it's a story that I think that many of us here in North Dakota will be watching closely as the country turns to perhaps newer technologies and more up-to-date technologies with nuclear power.
Absolutely.
Dave, it's just 5 years ago on January 6th this week that hundreds of rioters stormed the Capitol, and our own Todd McDonald had a reflection from Senator Cramer about what he experienced. Dave, what do you remember about that day and how it was reported here on Prairie Public?
I'll tell you what I remember about that day. I had a television monitor on in the newsroom here and was watching one of the networks, and I couldn't believe what was happening. And then NPR went to wall-to-wall coverage. And I remember talking to some people around the state capitol after that, and they all said, thank heavens, because we're nicer here, which is kind of a nice thing to say, but still you're looking at that situation, you're wondering what the heck is going on. So I know that there was some very, very tense moments for even members of our delegations of North Dakota and Minnesota. So it's something we shouldn't forget, I think.
And I'll never forget it either, Dave. I was in the middle of an interview with the minority leaders from both the House and the Senate of the Wyoming legislature when we all together learned about what happened. And just an aside, current candidate for governor in Wyoming, Eric Barlow's daughter, was in the Capitol when this was all going on. She was an intern for Senator Cynthia Lummis. So glad to hear that, of course, she was okay. Quite a day. Something we'll all never forget.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about a little more fun piece of news, Dave. A piece of history. A 100-year-old fire engine is used in Bismarck. and it's running again.
Right. And the story is so much fun because, you know, it was the first engine in Bismarck. It says engine number one. And it actually was one of the ones that responded to the state capitol fire in 1930 when the capitol burned down. Well, in the late 80s, somewhere around 87, 88, it was just decommissioned and they auctioned it off. And I'll never forget this. A person from Mandan, they run the Huff Hills ski resort down there, and they have a museum down there, and they were bidding, and he came and I talked to him at this ceremony where they started the engine up again, and he said to me, "Yeah, it was me and somebody from Fargo, and I was bound and determined not to let Fargo have this." And I thought that was pretty good.
Needs to stay closer to home, right, Dave?
Absolutely. And you know, it's what they did was when they bought it, they got it going and they'd take it to parades in Mandan, the 4th of July parade. And then by the time, you know, it rolled around, they put it back and they put it into the museum and they didn't take it out as much. City of Bismarck called saying, "Do you still have it?" And they said, "Yeah, can we buy it back?" And so they bought it back and now they've restored it so it will run and the siren works and the bell works. And they're going to be using it in parades in Bismarck, Mandan, and they'll have some kind of permanent display for it.
That'll be nice, and we'll look forward to seeing and hearing that restored 100-year-old fire engine. Dave, we reported earlier with our discussions with the North Dakota Monitor folks about the special session that's coming up. From your perspective, what's the latest, and what will be discussed?
Well, it sure sounds like the one item is to accept this $199 million and spend it. But there are legislators who are saying maybe we can open up some other discussions. One, Representative Nathy from Bismarck, has drafted a bill to provide free school lunches. And remember, the legislature turned it down, and now there's an initiative measure to do that. And he says, well, maybe we can get out in front of this and get this thing going. Whether or not it gets introduced is going to be up to the Legislative Management Committee.
Right.
They will act as a de facto delayed bills committee on which things can be and cannot be introduced. And they really do want to keep it to a three-day session.
And that'll start, of course, January 21st. Mm-hmm. And Dave, I did note that the North Dakota Hospital Association's president, he's happy about the $199 million award to strengthen rural healthcare here in North Dakota.
Yes, he liked the idea of the focus on, you know, getting facilities closer to the rural people and working on ways of hiring more medical personnel. So he says those are really going to be good things for North Dakota.
Dave Thompson, he and I review the news every Thursday here on Main Street. Dave, it's nice to have the new year back with you. I wish you the best. You'll have a busy couple of weeks here coming up with the North Dakota legislature. We'll all be listening.
Certainly will, Craig. Thank you so much.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and at North Dakota's gateway to science, learning doesn't just happen behind glass, it happens up close. A new grant is helping make one of North Dakota's gateway to science's most fascinating exhibits even more hands-on, the honeybee hive. Annie Beck is a STEM educator at North Dakota Gateway to Science, and she's here to tell us how donor support is helping connect visitors with the science of bees. Annie, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. For visitors who may not realize it, North Dakota Gateway to Science already has a live honeybee hive. Can you start by reminding us where it's located and why it's such a unique part of the museum?
Yeah, absolutely. So down the hill towards the river from our building, we have a big sign that some of you may have seen as you're driving on the interstate. And right behind that sign is our location of our hive. So it is far enough that the bees have their safety in their own space, but close enough where they can take advantage of our wonderful pollinator garden that our community master gardeners have helped with. And the whole purpose of it is to teach about the importance of bees, whether it is our any of the natural plants that we have that they help pollinate or any of our agricultural plants that they help pollinate as well. And so with the Bee Grant, which is a program with the Bee Cause Project and Whole Kids, we are going to be able to even enhance that exhibit further and bring it into our gallery. Some of our possibilities that we might include a camera inside the hive so that our guests can view what's going on as the bees are doing their daily work. And also an exhibit inside the gallery, kind of showing exactly what makes up the hive, different jobs that the bees have, and it's helping them understand a little bit about the importance of bees.
What happens to the hive during winter?
A great question. That was something that I actually wondered too when we were first started to think about this. We have one of our wonderful beekeepers who has the hive all insulated and protected so the bees stay cozy and warm during the winter on his property. And then they will return as soon as it starts to warm up, and it starts to be about 50 degrees or so late spring.
So what are the goals for this grant then specifically, and what will visitors be able to do or see that they couldn't do before the grant?
Yeah, so in keeping for bee safety and human safety, we don't have a lot of physical access right with the hive that we currently have. So through this grant, whether it is through live video footage of what is happening at the hive, or having components of hives or information about the bees, they can learn more and engage with it without actually being physically right at the hive with the bees.
Just a quick aside, I think I've learned since we've moved to North Dakota that this state is the top honey producing state in the country.
We are, absolutely.
How important is donor support in making exhibits like this more interactive rather than just something to look at?
We couldn't do it without donor support. We love our guests and visitors and the community connections that we make with our donors, large and small. And they enable us, whether it's different programming or different physical exhibits that we have, to bring in resources that we wouldn't be able to do on our own.
Annie, remind us exactly how to get to the North Dakota Gateway to Science and when you're open.
Yeah, so we are right off the BSC campus, right along the river. So a quick exit off the interstate, the first exit when you get into Bismarck. And we are open 6 days a week. The only day we aren't open is Tuesdays. And Sundays we are open the afternoon. Other than that, 10 to 5.
And of course, you're available to be seen online. You can Google that. You also have a nice Facebook presence. Yeah. Annie Beck is the STEM educator at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Thanks to the Whole Kids Bee Grant and community support, visitors will soon have even more ways to safely explore the whole world of honeybees. And it's just so fascinating, right in our own backyard. Annie, thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Imagine flying to another continent to live with your new in-laws in a place with few creature comforts. Such was the case for Lisa Arnold, today's featured storyteller from The Tell, Fargo's live monthly storytelling event. Oh, and fair warning if you get squeamish at descriptions of how meat is made. Here's Lisa's story of her transnational family from the December 2025 show at The Tell.
I have never done this, and I've also never been here before, so forgive me in advance. So I want to tell you a story about my transnational family. 8 years ago, I married somebody from Sudan, and 3 years ago, I visited Sudan. And I have lived overseas in the past, and I have traveled a lot, and I have studied other languages and other cultures. And I have never been to a place like where my husband is from. And I just want to tell you a little bit about how hard it was and how horrible it was in a lot of ways. Don't worry, this has a happy ending. But but let me give you some examples. From the beginning, the trip was very, very hard. We were there for about a month. And my husband's family lives in a village about 2 hours away from Khartoum, which is the capital of Sudan. And at the beginning, we were kind of placed into an apartment that seemed to be very dirty. It's kind of hard to stay in. I thought immediately we were going to drive, to the village. But it turned out his family was kind of trying to keep us in Khartoum for a little bit because the house that my husband had paid a lot of money to finish building was not finished yet. And this is the house where his family lives. But it's not kind of a house like you might think of here. Everything is kind of outdoors. And so the house that I'm talking about is like a brick handmade house. And they already lived in other sort of parts of the outdoors, but the house itself was, you know, it had a bathroom inside, which was, I didn't realize how important that was until I got there. But actually, I realized that my husband had made sure that there would be an indoor bathroom for me. It was like the most loving thing he's ever done. But they were kind of trying to keep us from going because his cousin, who had promised to have it all finished before we arrived, he hadn't quite finished all the work yet or had somebody finish all the work. But after about 3 days, we insisted and we were taken to his village. Everyone is so amazing. Like, he has the biggest, warmest, kindest family I've ever met, besides my own, you know. But from the beginning, we had to eat a lot of meat. And this is important because I used to be a vegetarian. But it's very traditional when visitors come, maybe as a celebration, a sheep is killed and butchered and cooked, and every single part of the sheep is cooked. And this was new for me, and I'm open to it. And I, you know, I had stopped being a vegetarian, but I was a vegetarian previously for about 10 years. So it was hard to kind of transition to an all-meat diet. But I did it, and after about 2 weeks, I got pretty sick. And again, luckily the bathroom was inside, not outside. So that was interesting. Also, while we were there, there was one of the big holidays for Muslim people. It's called Eid al-Fitr. And it's not the one at the end of Ramadan that's more famous, but actually it's the more important holiday, which I, from what I understand. And there was even a sheep in our sort of courtyard the morning of that holiday, and he was really cute. And I had to semi-witness him being butchered. So there was a lot of stuff like that that was just so incredibly difficult. Coffee is a very interesting tradition in this village because I learned how coffee is actually made, which is from the beans, which are green, and you have to roast them for a really long time. I didn't know that before. It also took a really long time. Everything took a really long time, and it was boring. Guys, it was so boring. There were days there was nothing to do. And actually, my relatives would tell me, just go sleep. I thought they were telling me to go sleep. It actually turns out that they were using a word in Arabic that means sleep, but in Sudan, it actually means, please go take a rest. Please relax. And I had no idea until like 2 years later. Like last year, one of his family members finally explained to me, no, they didn't mean go to sleep. I had no idea. I see the yellow light. So let me fast forward to the airport. So we were there for a month. It was hard like that all the time. The language I didn't understand. It felt like I was inside of a glass, you know, a glass bubble, and that everything was muffled, and I could halfway sort of understand the subject, but no details whatsoever the whole time I was there. That was really, really hard, really, really lonely. His sister was amazing. She was so incredibly kind. She spoke not a word of English, but we understood each other very well. It was amazing. At the airport, after a month of being there, I knew we were not going to leave, and I was almost right. But I believe that they held the plane for us, which I was really, really grateful for because I had never missed home so much. But you know what? When we arrived home, I actually missed Sudan tremendously in a way that I had not expected. And it's sort of a lingering feeling. We haven't been able to go back. If you guys are aware, there's a war there. Really devastating, really horrible. Thankfully, his family is fine. But that is my transnational family. Thank you.
That was Lisa Arnold's story about longing for home, both near and far. Lisa wanted to correct the pronunciation of a word that was part of her story. The Muslim holiday she referred to should be pronounced Eid al-Adha. Thanks for the correction, Lisa. You can try telling a live story yourself or witness profound and often profoundly funny tales at the Tell. This month's show at the 4 and 4 above Side Street Grill and Pub is tonight. There'll be music, libations, and lots of great personal stories like the one you just heard. Showtime is 7 p.m. If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 8th. The rosy, leave it to beaver portrayal of the American economy in the 1950s and 60s was not reality for many Americans. By the 1960s, fully 20% of the population was living in poverty. President Kennedy's advisor, Walter Heller, prepared a report warning that some Americans would remain trapped in poverty even with full employment. The elderly, the disabled, and single women with children had little hope of improving their financial situations. Kennedy was moved by the report and instructed his staff to develop a plan to address poverty. Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson was thrust into a new role when President Kennedy was assassinated on November 22, 1963. Shortly after being sworn in, Johnson met with Heller. Having grown up in poverty himself, the issue resonated deeply. On this date in 1964, Johnson delivered a game-changing State of the Union address. He was not one to do things halfway. He declared a war on poverty. Drawing from personal experience, Johnson made clear that poverty was not the fault of those who were poor. He asked, "Our task is to help replace their despair with opportunity. This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America." The war on poverty reached every state, including North Dakota. It helped alleviate some economic struggles through direct support and community development. Remembering hunger from his own childhood, President Johnson strongly backed initiatives to combat food insecurity. Programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, helped low-income families access food. But Johnson did not want people to rely on government assistance indefinitely. He wanted to provide pathways out of poverty. The Job Corps was designed to offer career training and educational opportunities. In North Dakota, the Quentin Burdick Job Corps Center in Minot encouraged students to pursue training that led to stable employment. The center operated until its closure in 2025. The Head Start program had been active in North Dakota since 1965, helping young children build a strong foundation for success in school. North Dakota has also worked to supplement federal efforts. The state enacted programs such as the Community Services Block Grant and heating assistance to support vulnerable residents. Today, North Dakota's poverty rate stands at about 10%. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
The mayor of Minneapolis is pretty sure what he thinks of a shooting in his city.
To ICE, get the out of Minneapolis. We do not want you here.
Homeland Security officials offer a different story that video does not back up. What questions remain and what more information comes to light? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Following Main Street tonight at 8 p.m., it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. His provocative topic, what does socialism mean to you? Friday at 3 p.m. Central, we'll re-air The Middle, and at 7 p.m. tomorrow, we'll air Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll look forward to seeing you again Monday, right here on Main Street.